Thank you very much, Moshe. Let me say it's a great pleasure to be here. I congratulate the Fields for supporting this wonderful set of conferences and salute the IFID. This fills a much-needed gap in the conference circuit. Can you hear me at the back? Okay, great. Jeff did a very nice job of providing an overview, and there's certainly a few hooks that I can latch onto that will lead into my talk. I'll be talking about something a little more specific, but perhaps nonetheless interesting. I think we've noticed that investors like to have their cake and eat it. They like the opportunity of good returns when the market goes up. They like some protection when the market tanks. And insurance companies, to some extent, have tried to cater for that. The product I'll be discussing is a particular feature of the variable annuity that Jeff discussed. And I would agree that certainly the fees in this product are quite high. But in an interesting way, they may be moving a little bit in some of the directions that he was suggesting. This particular feature, this embedded option, allows for people to get a guaranteed rate of withdrawal, and the more recent products permit you to get a fixed withdrawal, a fixed amount for life. Essentially, you invest in a mutual fund, and you have the guarantee that you can withdraw, say, 5% of the initial investment for life. So if the market does well, you get the benefit, and if the market does badly, you've got the guarantee. I should point out that this is joint work with my postdoc, Sangara Dravium, and PhD student, Yan Liu, and they're both here, and I thank them for all their many hours of work on this. Moshe said about 40 minutes, and you'll keep me honest. Okay, here's also Deep Patel, who's a former student now working in industry, has helped avoid the big embarrassing mistakes, but perhaps there's the little embarrassing mistakes are still here. It's always tricky as an academic. You write about the real world, and you may get things quite wrong. A little background on variable annuities, and thanks to Jeff, we don't actually need to go there. Something about investor objectives, and then this guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefit. What a set of words. I mean, each of them's boring. And so it's not a very interesting name, but that's the name they've come up with. We look at the basic features, and then we'll step back and think optimally for a sort of standard expected utility maximizer in a variant of the Merton model, what would they do? And then we'll show that that's possible, but maybe a little difficult. And then we'll relate that to our guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefit, or GMWB, as it's called. Then we'll do some pricing in a rather idealized setting where we abstract from a lot of institutional realities. And that will give us some insights into the pricing of this product. And particularly, we look at the sensitivity to certain financial variables. One of the fascinating things about working in insurance and finance is that people aren't always rational, and that can be terrible or it can be a challenge. We prefer to look at it as a challenge because people don't optimally exercise their options. And in many ways, this is like the mortgage market, where people have can prepay or default, and these two options interact. And some of that goes on in this particular product. We'll some preliminary steps about modeling this. We'll use a multiple state model just to capture what's going on. First, with just deterministic things that only depend on time or transitions, and then we'll try to modify that by making these transitions depend on the underlying economy, and that's interesting, ambitious, and we've just started that work. And then a few concluding remarks. So I guess the format is you keep your questions to the end, but if there's any one that's a burning question, I'll be happy to try to answer it. Okay, we've seen some of this before. Investors do like the possibility of upside appreciation. They're concerned about downside risk. And there's been a proliferation of insurance and annuity products that strive to combine both features, mostly in the accumulation phase. And then these variable annuities have different embedded options, quite a slew of embedded options. Actually, they're called, people in insurance call them riders. I guess it's something that rides on the back of the product. It's an interesting name. And the one that we're going to talk about is the GMWB, very popular in the market. And the only paper I've seen on it is a nice paper by Moshe and Tom. So there, it hasn't received a lot of academic attention. Well, basically, this is a feature that a person can add to a variable annuity. It provides a guaranteed floor of income to the policyholder. And imagine a policyholder invested $100,000 in a variable annuity. And this could be in a stock or market portfolio. Usually, it's got some bonds in there as well. And there's reasons we'll see why the insurance companies do that. And this particular feature enables the policyholder to withdraw a fixed percentage. 7% is typical, but there's many, many variants. Until the initial premium is withdrawn. And this year, I think, you now can have this withdrawal feature for life. You can take 5% of the initial deposit as long as you live. But we'll just go with the fixed term one with a 7% withdrawal rate, and that should last just over 14 years. So you can start withdrawing, and you have this a fixed amount of $7,000 per year for those 14 years. And that particular feature, you can withdraw the money irrespective of what happens to the market. So here's an example. The market does well at first and then tanks. So this is sort of the opposite of the investment. Some of you may have read Moshe's thing in the Globe. His investments do really well. So this is someone who's shorting you, Moshe. So this particular fund earns 10% in the first couple of years. And then 2 years, really terrible, 60%. And then the fifth year it earns, this is just to round the numbers, it also does not as bad as before, but it earns minus 2.8%. So the fund before withdrawal, you invest 100,000, you earn 10%, it goes to 110. And then you withdraw your 7,000, and that's in blue. So your fund after withdrawal is 103,000, and then the balance remaining, you started off with this guaranteed fund of 100,000, you deplete it by 7,000, so you have 93,000 left in your guaranteed fund. The next year you earn 10%, so your 103,000 grows to 113, you take off 7, it's down to 106, and the balance remaining in your guaranteed fund is 93 minus 7 is 86. And you can see how this happens. The next years 3 and 4 are pretty terrible. So you still get your 7,000, but your actual fund is going down really rapidly. If you get a few years of return of minus 60%, that'll do it. And at the end of year 5, your actual mutual fund account is zero. But you still have 65,000 left in your guaranteed fund, and that will enable you to pay 7,000. You'll receive 7,000 per annum for the next 9 years, and if you noted those in red. So you could think of those red numbers as coming from a different pot. Now this, of course, is one scenario. You could have the scenario where the market does really, really well, earns 10% per annum for the next 14 years, you will get your 7,000 and you will also have some money left if the market does really well. So to that extent, it combines the best of both worlds. Well, what this person seems to be after is a fixed level of consumption, and we can just look at the classical Merton approach, where you have a risky asset and risk-free asset. Investors maximizing expected utility of consumption, and under some very strong and simple assumptions, Merton found a very beautiful solution that you just put a constant fraction of your wealth in the stock, and it's the risk premium divided by the variance times the risk aversion using power utility. So this is the Merton solution for a person who wasn't worried about any having a fixed level of consumption in each period. This would be the optimal investment strategy. But suppose the investor wanted a fixed level of consumption of C1 per annum. That can also be solved in a similar sort of way using duality and the solution in Karatsis and Shreve. And what you find is you've still got the Merton ratio, but then it's multiplied by a fraction. And WT is current wealth. LT is the present value of the future amount of C1 per annum. And then you divide that by WT. So we've defined LT just below, and you can see that LT is just the discounted value of the future guaranteed consumption. So what happens here is you put money in stocks as long as your wealth lies above that threshold. If wealth gets close to the threshold, if W approaches L, that number gets closer to zero, so you put less and less money in stocks, you put more and more money in bonds. And you can see that that person, if the market does badly, will move very quickly to bonds and lock in the rest in bonds. So that would more or less produce the desired outcome that the GMWB produces, but I submit to you it would be hard to implement. And it's got a lower allocation to stock than the Merton solution. So let's just take an example here of an expected return in the stock of 8%, the risk-free rate is 4%, the volatility is, say, a market is 20%, and alpha is minus 1. And the Merton ratio for that is 50% in stocks, and it doesn't depend on the investor's wealth. But if you had a 15-year horizon, and you're paying 100 over 15, which is 6 2/3, is your guaranteed floor. Let's just simulate one stock price path. We could do many of these. And what you see is kind of interesting, as the wealth, this is where the market does badly, and of course you're taking off the fixed consumption amount from your portfolio each period, or you're doing it here continuously. The red line is the Merton portfolio. The blue line is a particular simulation. You start with less money in stock, and then at year 11, you've hit that threshold, so you just convert everything over to bonds and sit there for the rest of the period. So this particular investor will invest less in stocks, and it's a more dynamic strategy. It's probably, you know, easy for financial economists to do this, or relatively easy. For an investor, perhaps a little more difficult. So the insurance company tries, I guess, to some extent, to fill this need. This GMWB adds this sort of rider. The policyholder gets a fixed level of income no matter what happens to the market. And of course, insurance companies know one thing, they know how to charge, and there's a fee charged for this product. And the fee can be charged in either of two ways. As a percentage, maybe 50 basis points of the underlying assets in the, say, mutual fund, or it could be a percentage of the of the guaranteed balance. We look at the situation where the fee is taken from the account value, and you could think of this as a bit like a dividend. It's a proportional fee that's withdrawn steadily each month, each day, whatever, from the policyholder's assets. And once the assets hit zero, there's no more fee, of course. Well, let's start with a rather ideal world where we've got a frictionless market. Let's ignore lapses, partial withdrawals, mortality, all that good stuff. And let's assume as well that the maximum amount is taken each year. You don't have to take the maximum amount. In fact, you can take out one of these contracts and just sit with it, and you still pay the fee, but you don't have to take the guaranteed amount you decide when you start this. And the term is over 0 capital to t. So we'll assume the Brownian motion for the market, mu is a drift, and sigma is a volatility. Well, let V sub t be the investor's account. And this V has an absorbent barrier at 0. Once it hits 0, it stays there. And the dynamics of V are, as long as it's positive, it follows that stochastic differential equation. Mu minus Q. Q is the proportional fee that the insurance company charges. So that comes off every year, or every continuously. And minus G. G is the withdrawal amount. Here we're assuming the person withdraws. So the withdrawals serve to reduce the value of V. And then you've got the volatility at the end. If the initial investment amount is I0, then G would be defined to be I0 divided by T. There's a couple of ways to price the contract. The first way is to think of the investor paying this amount I0 at time 0. And this will give the investor a guaranteed stream of G per annum plus a call option on the terminal value of his account. And the strike price of that call option is actually 0. Q is the fee, and that's the thing you can control. And so the problem is to find Q so that this thing is priced by no arbitrage, that the initial value of the account is equal to the discounted value of those benefits plus the call option. We're assuming constant interest rates here, and C0 is the time zero value of the call option. So you can use some sort of fixed point result to get the equilibrium Q. You can use that, my students have done, both using a PDE or Monte Carlo. We use both. Sort of stuff I'm interested in, but it's kind of boring to go into it all. And you can use lots of variance reduction with the Monte Carlo. The other way is interesting, and this is the way that people in the industry think about it, I think. The investments often in a mutual fund, that may or may not be within the control of the insurance company. And the insurer here guarantees to pay the remaining benefits if V should hit zero before the contract matures. And in this case, the insurance company is paying those $7,000 per annum that I denoted in red in the earlier slide. And this is a put option with a random time of exercise. If the policyholder's investment account stays positive, then the value of the payment on the put is zero. The option is exercised automatically when the account balance first becomes zero. So when you look at the put option decomposition, the insurer agrees to pay the remaining stream of withdrawal benefits of G per annum, and it's got a random exercise time. And the guarantees are backed by the claims paying ability of the insurance company. I took that from the literature of an insurance company, so the question about, you know, the solvency came up earlier. It's those of you interested in sort of credit default swaps, it's really like a credit default swap. You pay a constant proportion and then the bad thing happens and you pay a claim. This is one particularly pessimistic value depiction of V. It starts at 100. At year 11, it hits 0. The put option's exercised, and the insurance company has to pay the remaining payments. So let's look at a benchmark contract here. No lapses, no deaths. All policyholders start to withdraw on day 0 at the max rate, and the input parameters are 100, contract term 15 years, the withdrawal rate is 6 2/3 per annum. Volatility is 20%, which probably isn't unreasonable. It may be high because often the portfolios, the insurance companies, as I say, put bonds in there. They don't, because these things, the value of the guarantee is sensitive to volatility. And the risk-free rate is 5%. And you can compute call and put prices for different values of the input parameter Q. Q is the contribution rate. So if Q is 0, then the present value of contributions is zero. Okay. So the higher you put that value of Q, obviously the higher the contributions will be. So this is a little graph. The value of Q in basis points, if Q is zero, then the present value of zero is zero. But there's still a put option, and the put option turns out to be on 100 initial deposits, 3.98. As you increase Q, then you increase the contribution rates. It's almost not quite linearly, but it goes up. So it goes up, and at 48 basis points, the present value of contributions happens to be 4.4. The put option also goes up as you increase the contribution rate. And the reason is, as you increase the contribution rate, you're taking more out of the fund, and you know that as the asset price falls, puts become more valuable. So the put goes up at a much gentler rate. But where those two are equal, that sort of is the no arbitrage value of the contract in this framework, and it turns out for us in this particular case, it's 4.4. So this depicts what's going on. Those bottom numbers are actually percentages. So that 0.005 is 50 basis points. And you see that the put option is a fairly smooth function of the contribution rate, where the contribution is almost linear in the present value of contributions is almost linear in as you increase the contribution rates, you increase their value. So that might give you the impression that the put is a sort of stable instrument or stable with respect to valuation. It turns out it really isn't. In this particular case, that those are the equilibrium values. Let's just look at a couple of little things. Sensitivity to interest rates. Our benchmark contract is an interest rate of 5%. If you have interest rates of 4%, the contributions hardly change, or 6%. So the interest rate don't affect the contributions very much. But the put option is you're discounting a future stream of payments. It is sensitive to interest rates, and as interest rates go down, the present value of bonds goes up. So your put option is quite sensitive to the interest rate payment. At 4%, it goes up to 6. And that's the graph. So the red line is the put option, 4% on the left-hand side of the x-axis, 6%. So it's quite sensitive to interest rates. Volatility, as you would expect, the put option is very sensitive, like all options, to volatility. It turns out that the contributions are hardly sensitive at all to this. So the insurance company seems to have hit a pretty nice thing here. The contributions that it's getting are always reasonably stable. And the last one is the account value. I skipped because we're running a bit of time. So the put option is much more sensitive to the inputs than the contributions. This thing has now been hedged because of an accounting ruling. And the hedging is sometimes done in-house, sometimes it's done by Wall Street investment banks or boutiques. And this is a thing that occupies insurance companies quite a bit. But I think the really interesting thing is to relax these assumptions and do this with some trepidation because we don't know exactly what assumptions we should be using here. But we should consider lapses, we should consider mortality, and we should consider rate of utilization. And these variables dynamically interact, and they make it a little more difficult and a little more challenging. This is a quote from the CEO of Lincoln Financial. GMWB accounted for 40% of total sales. It gained a strong foothold in key distribution channels. Only 7% of people electing the rider elected withdrawal at the full rate. So there goes one of our assumptions. We assumed everyone's withdrawn initially at the full rate. All the policyholders are taking the benefit. For this particular company, only 7% started off. And then this is very good. Well, of course it's good, because these guys are paying money to you and you're not, you know, it's a it's a very desirable thing for them. But, you know, what can you say? Okay. This gets tricky. We can't assume that surrenders follow the pattern of mutual funds or even other VA policies. I have reasonable connections with the insurance and actuarial industry, but lapse data are pretty, it's not released willingly. We expect the surrender to be influenced by the value of the guarantee to some extent. If the investment account is low, a policyholder thinking about surrendering might say, okay, I need funds, but I can actually start withdrawing. So I could, if I wasn't already withdrawn and the market does badly, rather than surrender, I could start to withdraw. And this should be factored into the construction of the hedge. And here are some of the reasons. We don't have very good theories about how policyholders will behave. There's very little published data on lapse data on contracts like this. And this is a very new product. Okay. So the last year or two wouldn't really be representative, perhaps, of the future. So we're going to use an actuarial tool. Well, it's not actuarial. A general sort of survival analysis tool called the multiple state model to model this situation, and we've oversimplified. I mean, this is highly simplified. We're going to assume there's three states. There's the in-force actives. These are the people who have bought policies with the rider, with the guarantee, and they haven't started to withdraw. And these people exist. At least they exist for the policyholders of Lincoln Financial, because only 7% have started. Then the next state in blue are those policyholders who are withdrawing, still alive, they're still active. I mean, they're still alive. They're withdrawing under the option. And then the final state, sort of magenta or purple, are policyholders who have exited. And these people could have died or lapsed. Okay. And I think this is pretty simplified, but it captured some of the things we want to do. So we're going to model assume transition intensities from one state to another. These transition intensities will initially be deterministic, just functions of time, because we know that people surrender more when the surrender charges fall off. So we've some clue as to the shape of these functions. But later on, we'll introduce dependence and economic variables. We'll bring in, like as people do in the mortgage area, economic covariates that change these according to different economic scenarios. So suppose a life enters the system, takes out a policy, a variable annuity, with a rider at age X. Actuaries always use X if you're male. If you're female, they use Y. I don't ask them. That's what they do. And mu ij X plus T is the transition intensity from state I to state J at time T later. So here's our little graph. On the top left hand are those of the active people. And at an instant in time, the transition or the hazard rate that takes you from state 1, where you've bought the policy and you're not actually withdrawing, is mu x plus t 1, 2. And the superscript says you started at 1 and you moved to 2. You could actually die or surrender without taking up the guarantee, and that would be the 1, 3, because 3 is the exit state. So you could go directly from state 1 to state 3. Or you could be withdrawing, and no one will live forever, and they possibly could surrender, or they could die, or perhaps take the money then and annuitize it. So those are the initial transition things, and these are initially deterministic functions of time. And initially we assumed, just on the basis of some reading the literature and talking to people, a 20% per annum for U12, and then a more for the surrenders, we looked at lapse data and conjectured something. So mu12 is 20% per annum, but we don't know if that's a good or bad assumption. That's what we used. the surrenders tend to peak when surrender charges drop off. So years along the bottom, the transition intensity could be up to 16% after 5 or 6 years, and then we've assumed it goes flat. So these capture roughly what's going on. Now that will change our lives quite a bit, because in the original model, everyone was drawn at time zero. Now only some people have started to withdraw, and also people leave. Just a little technical thing. These things are changing through time. We can, with some assumptions, get a sort of transition probability matrix. This is like a Markov chain, and this is just technical stuff. So let's value our benchmark contract and see what difference it makes. This is the contract we looked at before, where the equilibrium value of the fee was like 47 basis points. The initial investment was 100, 15 years. That's the withdrawal rate. The volatility is 20%. And we'll assume that once a policyholder starts to withdraw, that they will do it, continue for 15 years unless it's terminated. But now we're going to include, set this up in a multiple state framework, whereby we take account of lapses and surrenders and deaths in the way that I said. Well, what's kind of interesting is the bottom thing is our original thing, 4.4. The value of the contributions goes up. Well, that's because not everyone starts withdrawing. And if you're not withdrawing, your account balance is increasing more because you're not taking off that G every year. Right? So those people who postpone withdrawal are really helping. Those 93% of policyholders of Lincoln are contributing at a much, you know, it's the same rate, but it's on a bigger amount. So that's good. And the value of the put option goes down because some people have left. There's less people around to pick up the put option. And also, if you start withdrawing later, that reduces the value of the put option. So you can see that this actually helps the life of the insurance company. And these, even if we didn't get it right, the direction will still be the same. So another way to set it up is redo our model again, use the fixed point with these assumptions rather than the original assumptions, and find the new arbitrage fee. And in this case, it's like 50% of the previous one. It's only 24 basis points because you want to bring the contributions down and you want to increase the value of the put option. And so at 24 basis points, the value of the put option is 2.78 and the value of the contributions is 2.78. Okay, so I'd like to talk a little bit about the dynamic behavior. If the option is in the money, then it's more likely that people will start to withdraw rather than surrender. And this is a crude attempt to capture this, sort of looking at the literature. I mean, ideally you'd like to get the data and analyze it and back out appropriate things, but at this point this is the best we can do. So recall that mu 1.2 is the transition from those people who've bought this policy, they've got the rider on the policy, and mu 1.2 is the transition rate to start withdrawing. And we'll put the bar over the initial deterministic rate, which is actually 20% per annum. And then we're multiplying it by that multiplier, e to the lambda, and lambda will be a positive number. We'll vary lambda to change the intensity of the, you know, the economic effect. And then it's maximum of 0 and 1 minus A over G. A is the account balance, and G is the guaranteed amount. So if A goes to 50%, and G is 100, that's 1 minus 0.5 is 0.5. If lambda was 1, that would be e to the 0.5, which would increase the baseline hazard rate. So if it turns out that the market's doing badly, then more people withdraw than otherwise. And then for the surrenders, it'll be the reverse, because we think if the market goes down, people could surrender, but they have the option of withdrawing, So we'll adjust the surrenders in the different way. We just make that lambda a minus lambda. So that captures some of her intuition about how these people would behave. It's a little bit speculative, but it'll be interesting to look at it. So essentially what we've done, we've tried to bring dynamic policyholder behavior to this. And now in this particular graph, the value of lambda, the lambda on the runs from 0 to 3, and the value of the put option is going up as you move from 0, 1, 2, and 3. So the effect of people being a little more rational or obeying this model that we have assumed is to increase the value of the put option because they're not doing it mechanically. When the put's more valuable, they rush in and start to take on the withdrawal benefit. And and we've kept the contribution fee fixed at 30 basis points. So it sort of shows a little bit how the dynamic behavior changes the value of this rider. So just a couple of concluding comments. This happens to be a really popular contract. Maybe it's appealing to some of the things that Jeff mentioned, that policyholders or annuitants have the capacity to actually get a fixed withdrawal under this contract and now up for the rest of their lives and still benefit from some stock market appreciation. It does often contain an incredible number of bells and whistles. They have step-up provisions, and it seems to be the insurance companies do like to have their products identified. I mean, they don't make it easy for comparison. So there's lots of particular features and wrinkles on these products. Echoing the earlier talk, it's quite complex for the consumer to figure. I mean, it took us a couple of days to figure out, even with Moshe's paper, figure out what on earth is going on here. The value of the put option is very sensitive to the volatility of the underlying portfolio, and this is interesting. The insurance company often will write in, we can change the composition of the portfolio. Well, if you can change the riskiness of the portfolio, you have a lot of control over the value of the option. And one large insurer that we looked at gave a choice of 4 funds for its guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefit, and these are the names of these funds: Growth Blend, Value Blend. Almost looks like coffee, doesn't it? Growth and Income. But in each case, each of these 4 funds had, as I say, 40% allocated to bonds. Well, that will get your volatility down, and it'll reduce the value of the option. So there's kind of a conflict here going on. If you have a very risky fund, you're increasing the value of the option, and if it's less risky, you're reducing it. So I'm going to finish within my allotted time. So as I said, that I think I've given you a sense that this is actually a reasonably complicated product, and we've just begun to scratch the surface of it. It's very, very complex. So I think I'll end with a reference to a movie that some of the older people here might remember. It was Peter Fonda. This contract is not an easy rider.
We hold for questions. We're going to have a 10-minute discussion of this paper by Tom Salter, Deputy Director and Professor at York University.
Thank you, Fowler, for a very clear presentation on what I think is a very interesting topic. And you know,